WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so very much for tuning in. My name is Michael G. Haskins. Good morning, and we appreciate hearing from you and seeing you. Actually, we can't see you, but we can feel you. We certainly can. It's 7 a.m. Coming up next, it's a good day with Johanna Fernandez.
Good morning, it's 7:01 and you're listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day. Today on the show, we will hear from an undocumented immigrant from Mexico, Mirna, who has launched an impressive effort to feed her community in El Barrio. This report on undocumented immigrants in New York has been long in coming here on It's a Good Day, and we are humbled to be able to present it to you. Stay tuned for news and the weather. It's 7:03, and this is your update on the COVID apocalypse. There are now over 4.7 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 worldwide, and the number of deaths has surpassed 315,000, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Confirmed cases in the United States are closing in on 1.5 million, and nearly 90,000 have died across the country so far. New York State, the global epicenter of the pandemic, now has over 28,000 fatalities. Deaths in New York account for almost a third of all deaths in the United States. And here's your curated news. New York's new confirmed COVID-19 cases are predominantly coming from people who left their homes to shop, exercise, or socialize, rather than from essential workers. This according to Governor Andrew Cuomo. New York's data showed the number of new cases statewide has fluctuated between 2,100 and 2,500 cases per day. On Saturday, the number of new cases decreased to 2,419 from 2,762 on Friday. Cuomo has said that New York is hiring thousands of workers to trace the contacts of people who test positive for the coronavirus. Health experts say contact tracing is critical to isolating potentially contagious people in order to limit further outbreaks. And over the weekend, images surfaced of largely white crowds in Central Park and at Upper West Side bars drinking to-go beverages and ignoring physical distancing. There were no arrests and no beatings. This comes as the NYPD has been terrorizing Black and Latino people in the name of physical distancing enforcement. Earlier this month, sanitation workers in the New Orleans neighborhood of Gentilly went out on strike to protest working conditions. They were then all fired by Metro Disposal, a city subcontractor. Yes, they were all fired by a city contractor called Metro Disposal. To replace them, Metro Disposal hired formerly incarcerated people who will be sent back to prison if they protest their conditions. The former prisoners are making $1.33 an hour. This, my friends, is what slavery looks like in the 21st century. The sanitation workers were joined on the picket line by other frontline workers who showed up to express their solidarity earlier this month. Protesters were holding signs that said, "I am a man," echoing the signs carried by the sanitation workers whose picket line Martin Luther King Jr. visited in Memphis the day before he was killed in 1967. Let's take a listen to healthcare worker Zachary Kerwood and Lita Farquhar of Carpenters Local 1846.
All of us frontline workers, from sanitation workers to doctors and nurses to grocery store employees, all of us are putting our lives on the front line right now to make this city run. And we're being treated disposably. We're being treated not well.
Yeah, I've been thinking about these dudes for a while, seeing them do their job without any masks, any gloves. You know, they need PPE, they need hazard pay, and they need higher wages in general.
And in environmental news, the water is rising in the Great Lakes. In fact, since September 2014, the planet's largest collection of fresh water has broken and rebroken most of its long-term records. Last June and July, Lakes Superior, Erie, and Ontario all surged above century-old highs. And this April, Lakes Michigan and Huron hit new peaks after an unusually wet winter pushed their levels 3 feet above the monthly average. The rise in the water is likely the result of climate change, which has consistently exacerbated institutionalized racism. The excess water can have deadly consequences for those living along the Great Lakes' 5,241 miles of coastline. Back in 2018, a sudden flood caused an explosion of harmful E. coli bacteria in Michigan. The Keweenaw Bay Indian community was among the areas most affected, but the state did not offer to test the tribe's water. And last week, the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down the state's stay-at-home pandemic order as, quote, unlawful, invalid, and unenforceable, unquote. This after finding that the state's health secretary exceeded her authority. In a 4-3 ruling, the court called Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm's directive, known as Emergency Order 28, a vast seizure of power. The ruling says the judges weren't challenging Democratic Governor Tony Evers' emergency powers, but the decision effectively undercuts the governor's administration and forces him to work out a compromise with the Republican-controlled legislature. And as we all know, 45 uses press conferences as self-promotional events. But last week, a group of three female members of the White House press corps refused to play Trump's game. And we know how that game goes. When 45 doesn't like a question or feels pressured, he ends a conversation by calling on someone else from a rival network. But last week, his signature move suddenly failed. First, the CBS News correspondent, Weijia Jiang, pressed him on the racist undertone of his comment to her. And when he called on Caitlin Collins of CNN, and again on Yamiche Alcindor of PBS, both refused to bail him out. So Trump simply called time on the proceedings and literally fled the stage. Let's take a listen.
That the U.S. is doing far better than any other country when it comes to testing.
Yes.
Why does that matter? Why is this a global competition to you if everyday Americans are still losing their lives and we're still seeing more cases every day?
Well, they're losing their lives everywhere in the world. And maybe that's a question you should ask China. Don't ask me. Ask China that question, okay? When you ask them that question, you may get a very unusual answer. Yes, behind you, please.
Sir, why are you saying that to me specifically?
I'm telling you. I'm not saying it specifically to anybody. I'm saying it to anybody that would ask a nasty question.
That's
like that.
That's not a nasty question.
Please go ahead.
Why is it
matter? Okay. Anybody else? Please, go ahead in the back, please.
I have two questions.
No, it's okay.
But we'll you pointed here. To me. I have two questions, Mr.
Next.
President.
Next, please.
But you called on me.
I did, and you didn't respond, and now I'm calling on the young lady in the back, please.
I just wanted to let my colleague finish, okay. But can I ask you
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
It's 7:12, and you're listening to non-corporate listener-funded Community Control WBAI, streaming globally at WBAI.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day. And yesterday, May 17th, 2020, the legendary housing activist and literary agent Frances Golden died at age 96. Frances Golden famously battled Robert Moses and City Hall over plans to bulldoze 12 blocks of the Lower East Side. The urban renewal plan proposed to create a middle-income complex while displacing 2,400 tenants. But the fierce warrior, Frances Golden, wouldn't have it. Alongside other tenant organizers, Frances founded the Cooper Square Committee, liberated the land from redevelopment interests, and implemented an alternate community plan. Her plan preserved low-income housing in the neighborhood. It was approved in 1970, but didn't gain traction until the 1980s. Earlier in 1959, Frances Golden also helped found the Metropolitan Council on Housing, the famous Met Council, which is the largest and oldest tenants' rights organization in New York City. Frances Golden's vision was finally brought to fruition after more than 50 years of struggle. In 2012, tenants in the Cooper Square Mutual Housing Association's roughly 325 apartments were able to buy their homes for as little as $250. Frances was a powerfully erudite advocate and lover of the word, so she also founded the Golden Literary Agency. And she founded the Frances Golden Literary Agency to amplify radical voices. And she represented writers like Barbara Kingsolver, Adrienne Rich, Juan Gonzalez of Democracy Now, and the imprisoned radio journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, among others. In fact, she was the only literary agent to read Mumia Abu-Jamal's manuscript, Life from Death Row, in the 1990s. That manuscript, Life from Death Row, became a New York Times bestseller. Frances is also co-editor of Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. Frances Golden was born in 1924 to working-class Russian-Ukrainian Jewish parents. She grew up in Springfield Gardens, Queens, and Harlem. And in Queens, her family experienced anti-Semitism, which fueled her lifelong pursuit of social justice. Frances Golden loved the color purple, and she was my friend and comrade, and we will miss her dearly. But most importantly, we will honor her life by continuing to fight for the highest aspirations of humanity. Here is a report from News 4 New York about Golden's activity in the Occupy Wall Street protests. At the end, you will hear Frances Golden singing Study War No More with her daughter, Sally. She's also the daughter of Rini. Take a listen.
Among the hordes of protesters at Wall Street, Frances Golden, with her tuft of purple hair, stood out. The 87-year-old, who needed help standing, was trying her best to get arrested for a cause she has come to embrace.
Never good conscience that I ever do.
And even as demonstrators were pushed to the ground and cuffed around her, police would not indulge the elderly woman.
I said, if I shot you in the eye, he said, I'd give you a free shot. I said, what if I used my knee and kicked you in the groin? He said, you're not going to get arrested.
Golden says the first time she was arrested was here at Cooper Square. They were protesting Robert Moses's urban renewal plan. Because they were successful at stopping the plan, that inspired her to remain an activist throughout her life. Inside her East Village home, Golden showed us pictures of her activist past, from her run for state senate to her devoted pursuit of Mumia Abu-Jamal's release. This literary agent has seen it all, but there was something about the Occupy Wall Street movement that caught her attention.
Their spirit, their dedication, their love, just, it's like food. It just gives you the energy.
That energy allowed her to cross the Brooklyn Bridge. And
Frances Golden was
protesters, and she hopes this energy will allow her to continue supporting the movement until social justice is a reality.
I think that what this group has done and is continuing to do is let people understand the disparity and that our government is not taking care of the 99%.
In the East Village, Paisy Chang, News 4 New York.
Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more,
no more, no more.
I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Yay!
Beautiful.
Isn't that good?
Beautiful.
And that was Frances Golden, tenants' rights activist extraordinaire, lover of the color purple, comrade, friend. She is survived by her daughters Sally and Rini and a legion of friends and relatives who loved her dearly and whose lives she transformed. It's 719, and you're listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day, and it's 55 degrees. The high will be of 69 this Monday, May 18th, 2020.
Para mi niña linda, Leida Alejandra y Ramberto, con sentimiento.
What I've learned during these COVID days is that Saturday is a big day for food dispensaries and distributing food to the hungry in New York. And this weekend, my colleague friend, Pastor Dorlimar Lebron Malave of the First Spanish United Methodist Church in East Harlem, was knee-deep in this work when she called me to suggest that I interview Mirna, a migrant worker who's been engaged in the Herculean effort of feeding her community in the time of COVID-19. Here at It's a Good Day, we've been meaning to cover this story for some time, and so I called Mirna without delay. We spoke in her native tongue, Spanish, about the suffering she's witnessed in East Harlem and how she mobilized in service to something greater than herself. Yesterday, I spent all day translating the interview, and our production assistant, Shandani Smith, spent all evening doing the voiceover, and then we had a blackout, like at 3 o'clock in the morning. It appeared that we had lost the interview, and along With the interview, we'd lost more than a full day of work, and we were without a show for this morning. But then I called my trusted production angel, who saved us. We'll call him HM. I'd like to thank Pastor Lebron Malabé, her partner in crime, Raymond Perez, Mirna, the brilliant woman we interviewed, Shandani Smith, and HM for helping bring this interview to you this morning. There are approximately 12 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. In New York, an estimated 500,000 people are undocumented. And as we all know, Latino immigrants have mastered the lower rungs of the U.S. workforce. They provide almost all of the farm labor in the United States, and much of the labor for hotels, restaurants, construction, janitorial services, house cleaning, childcare, gardening and landscaping, delivery, meat and poultry packing, retail, and much more. These are among the most vulnerable essential workers in this country. And across the nation and here in New York, these workers labor in workspaces with the least COVID-19 protections. Yet despite risking their lives for America every day, these workers have been abandoned by the federal government. Most undocumented and documented immigrants pay U.S. payroll taxes and sales taxes. But that has meant precious little in four of the previous federal COVID-19 stimulus bills. Amid the greatest crisis since the Great Depression, all of these bills have denied millions of immigrants economic assistance and health care. The ACLU has denounced this exclusion of immigrants as downright racist and xenophobic. And I'll repeat, if you look at the fine script of these bills, the last four bills that were signed by the federal government exclude both undocumented and documented immigrants. On April 16th, however, New York City Mayor de Blasio announced the partnership with the Open Society Foundation to establish the New York City COVID-19 Immigrant Emergency Relief Program, reaffirming the city's commitment to ensure that all New Yorkers, regardless of immigration status, are included in citywide COVID-19 response and release efforts. The program will provide, however, a paltry $20 million worth of assistance, and many undocumented immigrants have said that they've not seen a thing. People from Latin America risk their lives to come here to the United States, and they do so in search of work, and they do so because they are fleeing economic devastation. Most were pushed out of their countries by over two decades of U.S.-led neoliberal economic policies in Latin America. They were pushed out by so-called structural adjustment. They were pushed out of their countries by free trade agreements, privatizations, the contraction of public employment, and the breakup of communal lands, or by the North American Free Trade Agreement, which allowed large American agribusinesses to set up shop in countries like Mexico tax-free. NAFTA essentially dismembered small Mexican farmers by putting them in competition with heavily subsidized U.S. agriculture. NAFTA put almost 2 million small-scale Mexican farmers out of work. And where do you imagine they went? They traveled across the border to the United States without papers and made their way to neighborhoods like East Harlem. The flow of these migrants more than doubled after 1994 and peaked in 2007. But the flow reversed after the recession of 2008, as more Mexican-born immigrants left the U.S. than arrived on these shores. other migrants come here seeking haven from the violence and persecution produced by U.S. imperialism, which has propped up dictators and employed the CIA to train militias to suppress popular democratic movements. And these militias are trained by the CIA to deploy torture, assassinations, and terror against civilians on a mass scale. In so doing, U.S. imperialism has unleashed bloody counter-revolutions in places like Guatemala in 1954, the Dominican Republic in 1965, in Chile in 1973, and in Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras, and Panama in the 1980s. The increase of Latino immigration to the United States is part of a worldwide upsurge in transnational migration generated by the forces of capitalist globalization. The anti-immigration lobby argues that these immigrants are, quote, drains on the U.S. economy. Yet immigrant labor generates incalculable trillions of dollars in profits and revenue for capital, only a tiny proportion of which goes back to immigrants in the form of wages. Let's take a listen to my interview with Mirna as she discusses the condition of undocumented immigrants in New York City.
Mirna, thank you so very much for joining us. Welcome to our show. Can you discuss with us the conditions that undocumented immigrants face here in New York City?
Well, yes, of course. But first, I want to thank you for being in touch with me. For the last 2 months, I've been in search of donated products, and I've also been in search of accurate information for those seeking funeral arrangements, and I've been seeking information that might help the community, because the immigrant community has been quite vulnerable in this period. On top of this, we are witnessing government oppression, because even though we pay taxes, we've been excluded from all government assistance. We are confined to our apartments without work, without residency papers with which to be able to find work, without food, and some immigrants have lost their loved ones or have become ill themselves. The impact to immigrant communities in New York has been unforgiving.
And can you paint a picture for us visually of what's going on? Because undocumented immigrants live in the shadows here in the United States. We don't really see their suffering because they're out of sight. They're in their apartments. We just don't see them. Can you flesh out their experience for us? Share with us perhaps the story of someone who might be going through a difficult situation.
There are many stories. For example, my neighbor, Guadalupe, whose husband died last week after having spent more than 30 days in a hospital. Intubated. She is without work, and her children were also infected with the virus. I have stories of young men who are confined in their apartments, who are undocumented, and who lost their jobs over 2 months ago, and they called me because they hadn't eaten in 3 days because they'd run out of savings and the modest supply of food they'd earlier collected. It's a very sad situation because there are no jobs and those that exist require papers. So this has led to some of them seeking false documentation, in part because employers are in fact suggesting that they would accept any documentation if they would be willing to work. The problem is that migrants are marginalized in this society, and I've warned them not to do that, that they'll be able to find jobs within their income tax filing number. But I have a lot of contact within the community, because I am of the community. I'm of the people. I am, too, among the vulnerable here in America. I, too, am a migrant.
Can you tell us what inspires you to do this work?
Well, I lost my job, and I was at home, and my brother was working in construction. And he told me that all of his coworkers had tested positive with COVID, and he asked if I might have anything to take to them. He was asking me for food. So I tried to get food from the church, but it took me a week. And when the food came, and we were finally ready to distribute it, one of his coworkers died the next day. So we weren't able to pack up the food for him because he had been sick and it was too late. I felt terribly and said, this can't be possible. How could he have died? I felt like I was in shock and thought to myself, this must be happening to others. And I started talking to my neighbors and to my contacts, and they too were telling me, yes, I'm sick, I have children and I can't go out, please help us, we need food. And so I started talking to the churches, and they started sending food. And then the next week, another of my brother's coworkers died, and I saw this was a bigger crisis than we really understood. So we called a Zoom meeting with the pastors I know, and they started giving us more food. They asked me to provide them with a list of what people eat, culturally speaking, and we collected beans, tortillas, rice, and some indispensable vegetables for migrants, and I started making what I called baskets of hope, and I knocked on their doors and left a little food for them, and I was like that until today.
Bueno, culturalmente le ponemos tortilla, frijol, arroz, vegetales.
Well, in order to meet the cultural culinary needs of the community, we include tortillas, beans, rice, vegetables, sugar, eggs, the basics. That's what we eat, jalapenos, potatoes, and if we have more resources, we add jello.
How many people go to the dispensary?
Estamos repartiendo ahorita todos los martes y a veces van de 100, 130.
We give food on Tuesdays, and we give food away to between 100 and 130 people. And we try to focus on people who are unemployed or who've suffered from COVID or people who have long-standing illnesses. We prioritize single mothers or people who suffer from domestic violence. We try to prioritize certain people because we have very limited resources.
Son sobrevivientes de violencia doméstica, o sea, tratamos de canalizar porque pues como es muy escaso lo que tenemos, no podemos abarcar mucho hasta el día de hoy, entonces uno me iba refiriendo con otro y otro me iba refiriendo y tengo una lista grande de llamadas, un grupo grande en mi agenda del celular que dice pandemia 2020 y ahí los iba yo agregando a todos.
And so others were referred to me by those who got food through word of mouth, and now I have a very long list of calls on my cell number under pandemic 2020. I started adding them all to that list, and I continue to look for food because I don't have the resources or a savings account to rely on these for needs. But since my husband and I were so close to many of the families whose loved ones had died, we decided that this is what we wanted to do to help them and to give out food. I'm still being called to pick up food, and I go and I redistribute the food. Today, we delivered food to more than 20 young men who hadn't eaten for more than 3 days. In the Bronx. The men used to work in restaurants, but because all of the restaurants are closed, they don't have jobs. There are many, and they are at a ravenous age. They eat a lot because they're young. They're between the ages of 17 or 18 to 30. They are no older than that.
The situation truly breaks one's heart.
Y otra profesora de Sony que casualmente hemos tenido más conversaciones y hemos hecho un poco, entablado un poco de amistad. Le pedí que por favor les llevara cosas de aseo personal.
And a professor from CUNY, with whom I have discussed these things and who has become a friend, I asked her to deliver personal hygiene items, shampoo, toilet paper, alcohol, masks, gloves. Those items are hard to come by. They are usually not donated. But if it is donated, we distribute them.
Me donen, yo lo reparto todo.
In fact, she donated feminine napkins because there was a woman in the group who had decided between feminine napkins or food for her children. So that professor was really helpful. She also delivered detergent to clean the bathroom, which is very important for containing the infection.
Y cosas para desinfectar el baño también, para que no se infecten ahí.
Pues claro, pues claro.
So let's review the story. You started doing this work because your brother, who works in construction, lost his job and asked you to help him and his friends with something, with anything.
Yes, because they all tested positive for COVID. They had been infected.
And they were infected at work?
Yes, at the job.
And where did they work? Do you remember?
They worked in different sites. I'm not sure how all that works in construction, but yes, here in Manhattan.
So they got COVID on the job, and they had to stop working. And what were their symptoms? I imagine they were all very young men.
It wasn't that they wanted to work. It was that their bosses forced them to continue to punch in at work. The men wanted to stop, but since they were not going to have any money, and obviously they had families, but the employer was not going to pay them for sick leave while they were in quarantine, so they were forced to continue to go to work.
But they had to stop working eventually, no?
Yes. Finally, when the city closed down, when the authorities finally said that no one could work, they stopped going. But by that time, they were all sick.
So tell me again, what did your brother ask you?
He asked if I had food. I told him that I was going to look for food, and he told me that all of his coworkers had tested positive for COVID, that they were sick, that they couldn't go out because the city had ruled that those who were infected couldn't leave their apartments. So I said, they're in quarantine, without food. How are they going to survive? And they're sick to boot. And some would go to the hospital and they were sent back home with no insurance. It was a terrible situation. But I said, we are not going to let them die. But one of them died. A number of them died.
And I imagine they were very young men.
Between 20 and 40 years of age. Some of them already had children and families.
So you started to spread the word about your work and to contact the churches in your own neighborhood, in El Barrio.
Yes, and then a person who knows me, who has an organization, collected $500, and with that I bought in bulk. I started growing the dispensary, and like that, I used to knock on doors, we would ask in churches or wherever.
Yo tocaba puertas, esa palabra la usamos como andaba pidiendo donde se pudiera.
And where are you from?
I'm from Puebla, Mexico.
And these persons who are in this terrible situation, where are they from?
Es una diversidad, hay de diferentes lugares y países también.
There's a diversity of persons in different places and different countries. Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico, Ecuador.
Do you know more or less the number of undocumented people who are here from Latin America who need help? Do you have any idea how many there are?
Well, of those I've helped, an approximation would be more than 1,000. I'm talking about those people we've been able to feed in their homes with a little bit of food.
What would you tell New Yorkers and North Americans about the situation that undocumented immigrants are living through? For my part, my parents are from the Dominican Republic, and we understand and tend to view the condition of undocumented immigrants with compassion.
The oppression that we live in here, we are marginalized. We are not accepted here or in any other part of the planet, because if we are in Mexico, we are displaced. If we are in our countries in Latin America, we are displaced. And here, we are in the front lines of everything, as essential workers, in the kitchens, as babysitters, as cleaners, in all of these jobs.
Si tuviéramos inclusión, no tendríamos que estar.
And we're just serving. The problem is that we're not included. We need inclusion. If we would have been included in the stimulus package, we would have prepared ourselves. We would have been stocked up with our savings. If we would have had access to a stimulus check, we would have been able to at least eat. But we do not qualify for coupons or health insurance, and our rent payments are piling up. Some of us have died. Some have left their children and their partners.
Tell me some more about the situation with the funeral homes.
Sí, las parejas, los hijos. Todavía en la mañana me habló un señor que
This morning I was speaking to a man who lost his mother-in-law and then his wife died. We helped him with the funeral arrangements because some of the migrants are indigenous from the high mountains of Guerrero. They don't speak Spanish well, and the funeral homes took advantage of so many with price gouging. From $2,500 to $17,000 for cremations. It was unbelievable how the prices shot up. And they couldn't understand why they were not able to hold a dignified burial for their loved ones or a dignified memorial service for a human being, a loved one.
En mis propias palabras digo, nos exterminaron como cucarachas, ¿no? Porque cayó esto en la comunidad más vulnerable de Latinoamérica. Personas que no tenemos documentos.
And I say, and these are my only words, that they exterminated us like cockroaches. Because this fell on the most vulnerable community, people from Latin America, people who are undocumented, that precisely because we are not included in this society, we have to live on top of each other to divide up the rent amongst ourselves, and that allowed the virus to spread even more among us, because there can be no physical distancing under these conditions. We have no health care. We feel rejected by the majority groups. They count us like numbers. They report that this number of them died and now dead. They stop being numbers. I've seen very young children whose parents were sick. Like a neighbor, for example, whose two little girls would come down to get the food, and I would call their mother and try to encourage her to fight for her life because she had to live for her girls. Their father was also sick, and I used to go to the schools to pick up food and deliver it to them, and now she sends me notes of gratitude. And all the while, it was very obvious to me that we don't die of infection. We are going to die of hunger.
Ahora en esos días me mandan mensajes de agradecimiento y todo, pero yo dije, si no morimos de infección, vamos a morir de hambre también.
They were charging that amount of money to cremate the bodies?
Yes, they were charging a lot, and they were saying that they were bathing the bodies, that they had to prepare the bodies. These prices were extremely expensive. I tell you, it was ranging between $2,500 and $17,000 to cremate, because cremation was the only thing that they were told could be done.
If our audience would like to support the cause, how would they be able to do that?
Yo primero que nada... conozco a mi gente es trabajadora, Yo primero les diría que las personas que tienen el privilegio de votar.
I know my people. My people are hardworking. The first thing I'd say to people who have the privilege of voting is to pressure Congress and senators so that laws are passed that mandate that all those who pay taxes be granted a stimulus check. To stop the exclusion of migrants. And if they do that, we could address the hunger we are seeing now. I've also noticed that the MTA is subcontracting to a company that in turn is subcontracting to migrants to clean the trains, to be on the front lines.
Contrató una empresa que está a su vez subcontratando migrantes para limpiar los trenes, migrantes para puras primeras líneas.
To be on the front lines and vulnerable to this virus. This is happening right now. The company is asking the migrants to look for a social security number, any number. They are suggesting that it doesn't even have to be a legal number. This means that because migrants are vulnerable, the company is inciting them and encouraging them to do things that will negatively affect their immigration status. I ask for inclusion, that they be incorporated into society like any other person. That they be given a social security number so that they are able to have the right to health care, so they don't have to depend on charity alone, so they'll be able to support themselves. They need valid social security numbers. This is what I ask for this community. I'm asking you to vote and to hold these vulnerable communities in your hearts in this time of global pandemic, which is so terribly affecting us.
Nuestra audiencia, que voten, que se pongan la mano al corazón esta pandemia mundial que está acabando con las personas más vulnerables, los está afectando demasiado.
And so can you tell us why are you here in the United States?
Yo llegué porque mi padre falleció igual desde esos tiempos, ¿no? Mi papá falleció en el 97 y mis hermanos se quedaron pequeños y yo veía el hambre, ¿no? Siempre.
I came here because my father died in 1997.
Para que mis hermanos crecieran, tuvieran.
And my siblings were very small, and I could see that they were hungry. And I came here to feed them so that they would have the opportunity to grow, so that they could go to school and have the things my father wasn't able to give me when he died. He couldn't put me through school. I had to figure out how to survive.
So you work here and you send money back home.
Pues cuando yo trabajaba y mandaba, ahorita también yo tengo desde la segunda semana de enero fue la última vez que me llamaron.
Well, I used to send money back home, but I haven't worked since the second week of January. And I worked cleaning homes, but people started leaving the city and going back to their country homes. I didn't really understand what was happening. It was finally the pastor in the church who explained that we had to practice physical distancing and that you have to cover yourself with a mask because a pandemic was approaching and it was coming to the United States. I didn't know any of this because I don't watch television.
Mirna, thank you for your work. We are here to serve you, and if you'd like to speak on any of these issues in the future, you are very welcome to our show.
Muchísimas gracias. Claro que sí. Pues ahorita muchos me están preguntando por trabajo, ¿verdad? Un trabajo digno. Entonces también hay personas que necesitan la ayuda, que si saben de un trabajo, saben, están dispuestos a adoptar a una familia, ¿verdad?
Thank you very, very much. Many of the migrants are here asking about jobs, a job with dignity. And if anyone in your audience knows of any openings, or if you're willing to adopt a family, to give one of its members work without demanding that they produce false documentation, that would help. These are hard-working people. The situation is out of bounds right now. It's out of control. But in the end, they're human beings. We're human beings, and we need work to bring food home to our families.
You've been listening to the voice of Mirna, a woman who has been feeding the undocumented community
in East Harlem, and I'm Johanna Fernandez, the host of It's a Good Day here on WBAI. And if you'd like to help Mirna in her efforts alongside of the efforts of churches in East Harlem, please email me at johanna@wbai.org. Once again, if you were touched by this story and you'd like to extend your support to Mirna in any way, financially, in terms of food, or just good wishes and solidarity, please email me at johanna@wbai.org. And as I was listening, I was reminded that New York City is the epicenter of real estate speculation. And when the pandemic began, construction workers complained that sanitary conditions were terrible at these sites and that there was no need to keep them on the job. And an upstate electrician remarked in one of the newspapers of New York City, quote, "I'm essential to the pocketbooks of rich contractors and essential for spreading the virus, but that's about it," unquote. After the protests, the essential industry designation was removed in New York City from these construction sites. I was just reminded of this because her brother was working at a construction site and he came to her to tell her that his co-workers were all sick with COVID-19 and to ask her if she could help. If you would like to help Mirna, please email me at johanna@wbai.org. Once again, you can email me at johanna@wbai.org. And if you think this program is valuable, please consider becoming a buddy of our show. You can call 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. That's the end of our show for today. You're listening to Non-Corporate Listener Funded Community Control Radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. This show is produced by Jorgen Ostensen, Ajamu Sankofa, and Shandani Smith. Shandani Smith was fabulous in this process, and we went through it last night, but we did it. Michael G. Haskins is our virtual board operator. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. I'm also a child of immigrants. Thanks for tuning in. It's a good day. See you tomorrow.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much, Johanna Fernandez and the team of producers. And thank you, those of you who are listening throughout our tri-state area and beyond through WBAI.org for supporting this commercial-free